It's easy in isolation to notice the authoritarianism of the Trump administration and to think that the best way to fight it is to ensure that authoritarianism doesn't triumph in the United States. What if the gravest risk is not one-party rule, but a kind of Balkan-style civil war where neighbor is against neighbor? Because the more open hostility there is on the streets of America, the likelier a descent into civil war. Well, well, well. It's interesting times. How are you feeling at the moment about American democracy? I always find that, you know, it reminds me of being, when I was at high school and university and you had to do an essay and try to figure out what you thought about the essay question, I would always look across at fellow students who read the essay question and then immediately launched into writing. And I would think, there's no way they're going to get a good mark because I haven't had time to digest what the point of the question is, to structure their argument, and to reach a conclusion that makes sense in advance, because they don't know where they're going with their argument yet. And I would always sit there after reading the essay question and spend the first precious 5 minutes of the essay writing time, not writing, but thinking and jotting notes and bullet points about how to tackle the issue. And I was thinking about that analogy the other day to the moment that we're living in, where we're being thrown an enormous amount of information and the news cycle seems completely overwhelming and daunting. And our natural reaction is just to grab a pen and start scribbling mentally about what our emotional response is. And maybe it's a time to not do that, because often our initial instincts and our knee-jerk reactions are the least constructive. But to pause and try to think not about the events, but about how we should think about the events. To think about how we should think about the events. And to talk about not the events, but how we should talk about the events. That is the point of this show, after all, to talk about our conversations and how we have conversations with each other, and to try to take a 30,000-foot view of things. So let's just try to maybe do that in some baby steps today. But to lay the groundwork of what we're talking about, America currently has a government which began by sending the army into cities that its president didn't particularly like and that it felt were obstreperous cities that also had high crime rates, but not the highest crime rates. Washington, D.C. is the obvious example. So the military, and in, you know, remember that in democracies, the military is supposed to be not used for domestic purposes. There is a firewall between law enforcement for the civilian population and military adventures for the country's defense. Except in extraordinary circumstances where the governor of a state requests the National Guard to come in and assist with a natural disaster, for example, a cyclone and such. But here you have the government of the United States sending the military in against the will of the locals to supposedly enforce the law. Then you have the United States government sending customs and border and immigration and customs enforcement agents into cities that do not have the highest rates of illegal migrants, but cities, again, that have been bold in standing up to the administration's goals about hunting down illegal immigrants, Portland and most recently Minneapolis. Then you have an American government that has begun arresting journalists for ostensible crimes, you know, causing a disruption in a place of worship, collaborating with people who are intending to disrupt the public peace through protests that impeded other people's expression of their religious faith in a place of worship. You know, there's always something on the books that you can get someone for. But we do not tend to charge journalists with jaywalking when they run across the road in order to talk to a source or to snap a picture of something that's going on. So the sense that there's a retroactive attempt to punish people for pretextual causes for the crime of being opposed to the government or opposed to the president. There's also this case that I have been repeatedly misremembering in recent podcasts, and forgive me if I have been butchering it on the couple of occasions in which I tried to raise it with bemused guests who just sat there looking at me blankly like a cow looking at a train. But the case that I've now looked up is the case of, in September, the U.S. Justice Department, Pam Bondi, at Trump's behest, when they were trying to attack the Federal Reserve because he didn't like the fact that interest rates were higher than he wants them to be, they launched a criminal mortgage fraud probe into the governor of the Federal Reserve, Lisa Cook, and issued grand jury subpoenas against her in Georgia and Michigan for supposedly defrauding. I mean, what it turned out to be was the accusation that she had said that her primary property was a property that wasn't her primary property and that actually it was a secondary property. But I mean, in complicated financial matters, the idea that someone like Donald Trump hasn't done things like that a bazillionfold, or that many, many of us, including many members of Congress, haven't been guilty of something if you pored over everything, is bizarre. And it was obvious that she was a target. She's a black woman, and so, you know, all the more of a target on her back. And they identified that they wanted to charge her with something, and then they found something. Now we have an American government that is sending the director of the National Security Chief, Tulsi Gabbard, which is supposed to be, an international spy chief, into the domestic affairs of Georgia's election officials, where she went down to Georgia, which has obsessed Donald Trump ever since 2020. He's been saying for years that he believes that the Georgia ballot was rigged. There's no evidence that it was. We have all heard the phone call of Donald Trump talking to the Secretary of State, Raffensperger, during the election counting process when Georgia had gone to Joe Biden in 2020, asking him to find 1,100 votes.
It's just not possible to have lost Georgia. It's not possible. When I heard it was close, I said, there's no way. But they dropped a lot of votes in there late at night. You know that, Brett. But regardless of those votes, with all of it being said, we lost by essentially 11,000 votes. And the people of Georgia are angry. The people of the country are angry. And there's nothing wrong with saying that, you know, that you've recalculated.
Well, Mr. President, the challenge that you have is the data you have is wrong.
And recently at Davos in Switzerland, the Economic Forum, Trump got up and said, I won the, he was talking to all the world leaders. I won in 2020. Everybody knows that. And a lot of people are going to be punished for their attempt to steal that, for their successful stealing of that election. He said, I might be breaking news here, but a lot of people are going to be punished.
It was a rigged election. Everybody now knows that. They found out. People will soon be prosecuted for what they did. It's probably breaking news, but it should be. It was a rigged election. Can't have rigged elections.
And days later, the FBI went down to Georgia with the National Security Director, Tulsi Gabbard. And she actually got Trump on the phone, on speakerphone, to give a pep talk to all the FBI agents who were poring over, basically seizing all of the ballots. They weren't able to get authority to seize the ballots from Georgia itself, so they did a workaround. Talk about just picking what you want to achieve and then finding a way to do it, regardless of whether or not it makes any sense. They found a workaround by getting a court to approve it in another state that's unrelated to Georgia. And remember, in America, elections are run by the states. It's not like in most countries where the election is run by a federal election commission or a national election commission. This is a state issue. Nonetheless, they got the authority to seize all of those ballots and the voter rolls, in order presumably to foment and concoct criminal cases against the people who did the right thing by processing the ballots. We don't know what's going to happen to those ballots. We don't know about the integrity of those ballots. Henceforth, they're in the possession of the FBI, and under normal circumstances, you would expect that you could trust the FBI to go through evidence diligently. When the FBI is run by Kash Patel, who is a henchman for the president and is overseen by Tulsi Gabbard, who is another, I shouldn't say henchman, a lapdog, say, a yes man for the president. It's it's not inconceivable that there would be questions about the integrity of the FBI investigation when it is so clearly motivated by the personal animus of the head of state, who has never believed that the Georgia election was clean, even though there's no evidence that it wasn't. And now we have the president saying that actually he was on Dan Bongino's podcast. This is the guy who was in charge of the ICE raids in Minneapolis, but was recently demoted and went back to podcasting, as we all do when other gigs fall apart. And now Bongino was talking to Trump, and Trump said, really, we should just have the Republican Party controlling elections in at least about 15 states where it seems like there's just chicanery going on. And the chicanery that he's talking about is the fact that those states don't vote for him. So rather than swatting at each of these things like a cat with a laser pointer, let's try to look at them holistically and think about how we write the essay of how to respond to this moment. Marcia Gessen had a good piece. She's a Russian-American dissident, fierce critic of Putin, and a scholar of authoritarianism, especially in Eastern Europe. She had an excellent piece in which she said, what we're seeing in the ICE strategy of sending in immigration and customs enforcement and border protection agents to cities that are that Trump regards as inimical to him to create a sense of crisis and indeed to end up, unfortunately, killing a couple of the protesters in the case of Minneapolis, is not authoritarianism the way we traditionally think of it. What it is, she argues, is, or I should say they, I think she's they now, is state terror. State terror being different from authoritarianism in the sense that under authoritarian rule, you sort of know exactly what the rules of the game are. You know that if you stay within certain parameters that you're going to be okay, and you roughly know where the line to cross is. You know, if you're living in, let's say, Eastern Europe under communism, you generally had a sense that you just have to say the right things about your fealty to the Communist Party. You have to not publish dissenting articles. You have to not try to stir up trouble against the government, and then you'll be untouched. In this precarious state position that America is currently in, Marcia's argument is it's more like the intentionally chaotic wielding of state power in order to induce terror in its citizens about the arbitrariness of that power, that anyone could be hunted, anyone could potentially be shot. You don't quite know where the lines are. Are you allowed to protest ICE agents? How much are you allowed to protest them? You know, a guy gets shot, Alex Peretti, and immediately there's a claim. The first woman who was shot, Ms. Good, the officials immediately said, with no evidence, that she was a terrorist. Immediately after the Peretti shooting, officials said that he intended to massacre law enforcement. I mean, that's just not true. Donald Trump told Fox News both of them were terrible. He said both of them were terrible. This is before there's any investigation. I mean, in the past, when there have been misdeeds or, you know, law enforcement overreach and people have been killed in the line of fire, even if it was, whether it was egregious on the part of the law enforcement or whether it was understandable, an understandable mistake, officials have usually taken a policy of, well, we're not going to talk about it until there's an investigation. We try to figure out what actually happened because we don't want to get it wrong. In this case, the instant it happened, she was a terrorist and he was intending to massacre law enforcement. The fact that he had a gun legally, he was legally allowed to carry a gun. He wasn't brandishing the gun. He wasn't pointing the gun. He had the gun in a holster and he was unarmed. The gun had been removed from him by the agents at the time that he was shot 10 times in the back, I believe, initially by two agents. The fact that he had a gun was then used by, I believe it was the director of the FBI, Kash Patel, to say, listen, if you're going to come into a scenario in which you're a protester, don't carry a gun and don't cause, you know, trouble. Well, I am old enough to remember the Tea Party movement against Obama, where there were a lot of conservative Republicans walking around with AR-15s strapped to their backs at protests, and they weren't all super polite. So the idea that the having of a gun at a protest should be a reason why you would get shot, and this is not to, I'm not, you'll, don't worry, I'm not fully drinking the left-wing Kool-Aid here. I will have something to say about the nature of protests in a moment. But I'm just making the point that the rules are just shifting all the time. It's not like living in an authoritarian regime where you kind of know what you have to do in order to get along. Here, it's not clear what you have to do. I thought it was okay to protest in America, and I thought that the right was okay with guns, indeed, as long as you're not using them. I thought they believed in the Second Amendment and the right to bear arms. And now, all of a sudden, that's being used by, like, the law enforcement as a way of telling me, by people who would normally be on my side, who would normally be pro-gun, as a way of saying, telling me that that was the line that I crossed. Well, since when was that rule made up? I mean, it almost feels a little bit like the experience of the left over the past decade, where all of a sudden there would be a particular word that you weren't allowed to use or something, or, you know, don't you realize that, you know, you're supposed to call illegal immigrants undocumented immigrants, or that, you know, you can't even say this particular racial slur if you're talking about how bad it is in conversation, or that even the argument that you should be able to say it, in the case of Mike Pesca, who was fired from Slate for not saying the N-word, but arguing that there is a place for white people to be able to discuss the usage or non-usage of that word and saying it in the process, although he didn't, was enough to get him fired. And it was sort of head spinning, right? It was like, well, hang on a second, what, where, how, who wrote, when, who wrote these rules? What am I doing? And now we're seeing the same thing much more violently from an incumbent American government with authoritarian tendencies, where all of a sudden it's like, well, yeah, this is the new state, the new way we do things now. We just retroactively charge journalists. We hunt down for why Federal Reserve governors might have something bad in their past. We make up a rule about how you shouldn't have been carrying a gun while you were protesting, even if you weren't using it. So Marsh's point is, it's intended to foment state terror. Even just the presence of army troops in a city like Washington, D.C., just wandering around armed, is a way of asserting state power and keeping people on edge, always making the civilians on their back foot, not quite knowing where they stand in relation to the government. So I thought that was a useful way of contextualizing some of what's going on. I said I would mention my thoughts about the protests. It's obviously awful that these people were gunned down, these two people, Ms. Good and Mr. Peretti, killed for just protesting. I would just say something about the nature of resistance here. Their method of protesting, which is not to blame the victim here, that they were innocent and they were murdered, but their method of protesting is, I don't think, the way out of this morass. It's not the playbook of nonviolent resistance that was exemplified by Gandhi or Martin Luther King, where these people were people who actually coordinated with law enforcement in order to enact large-scale staged demonstrations of civil disobedience in order to show up the corruption and the illegitimacy of the system that they were objecting to. And this happens all the time, by the way. I mean, when there's a big climate protest, when there's a big Gaza protest, the ones that come off without a hitch, without conflict, that are successful in articulating their message, are the ones where you do actually loop in the cops. Like, you tell them in advance we're going to be doing this thing. We're exercising our rights to, you know, to assemble. You may even need a permit to do so, and you get that, and then you go and you show up and you express civil disobedience. You might even not want to get the permit, but you do it in a nonviolent manner, and you don't put yourself in situations that play into the playbook that validates the narrative that the right wingers, or whatever system you're trying to object to, are trying to propagate, which is that you are an unruly, lawless troublemaker. You try to make it clear that you are a principled, moral objector rather than a ne'er-do-well, to use a nice term from the 1920s that we should use more of. So in that sense, it's not to say that the shootings were justified. They weren't. But it is to say that I don't think that the strategy, like, put it this way, every strongman and every fascistic regime in history has known exactly what to do with violent objectors. They know the playbook. Like, they're quite happy engaging in warfare because that's the language that they speak. There's us and there's them. There's the good guys and the bad guys. So if you come and you attack us, we're going to come back at you a thousandfold. That's the way that the logic of this kind of escalation works. So you go up and you spit in an ICE agent's face, as Peretti apparently did 11 days before he was shot. He'd had numerous altercations where he'd been in, you know, sort of wrestling matches and hostile matches with ICE agents, all out of good principle, I guess. I mean, he thought he was doing the right thing. He's trying to stop people he regards as being innocent, although they did break immigration law, but, you know, not all of them, I must say. He didn't, but people who he regards as being otherwise innocent of violent crimes from being rounded up by ICE agents. But the manner in which you do that is the question, and what is likely to be most efficacious. If you spit in their face and try to wrestle them to the ground, then not only are you putting yourself in danger, you're actually behaving exactly the way they want you to behave, and you're producing the images of unrest and violence and chaos that provide a pretext for a further doubling down of state power or even state terror. So there has to be a better way of approaching this, right? And nonviolent resistance strikes me in the realm of protest, and we'll get to in a second to some other ways we might be able to push back against this, but in the realm of physical protest and putting yourself on the street, nonviolent protest, to the greatest extent coordinated with authorities, strikes me as the most prudent way and most effective way of doing an end run around claims that the government might have that you're direct delusional and dangerous. Otherwise, you're just creating the kinds of scenes that are going to play on Fox News and are going to scare everybody and enable further tolerance of government overreach. It's a bit like the difference between the model of guerrilla resistance versus nonviolent resistance. What we've been seeing, but from the left against ICE on the streets of Minneapolis, is a guerrilla resistance, is a form of guerrilla resistance, which authoritarians know how to deal with. It's much trickier to deal with nonviolent resistance. I guess that's the point. One little piece of evidence here, which I think I heard from Michael Schellenberger, to give him credit, was that there are signal chat groups among these resistance, anti-ICE resistance protesters. Signal, the text messaging, the private text messaging app. And among the strategies is that any time you see an immigration customs enforcement agent trying to, you know, take someone away because they don't, they're not a legal citizen, they're here illegally, you should call 911 and report a kidnapping, but not tell the dispatcher that it's an ICE agent. You should just say, there are people being, I'm witnessing a kidnapping right now. And so this was taking place. Now, that is clearly a way of trying to create more violence. It's trying to create chaos. I mean, there's something a bit Joker in the Dark Knight about that, because law enforcement agents are going to show up under the impression that there's a kidnapping going on. They're not going to know what role the ICE agents are playing or why the ICE agents are even there. They're not going to know whether to believe the person who is talking who the ICE agents are trying to apprehend, who is asking to be rescued, or whether to believe that the ICE agents are actually ICE agents. So you're just creating a hot environment in which there's an enormous capacity for misunderstanding or violence between government agencies, state police on the one hand and federal immigration agents on the other. That is not a good faith tactic. I don't think that's that is definitely not nonviolent civil disobedience. That is a very shrewd and canny playbook to create more chaos. So you just have to step back and think, who does more chaos benefit, really? Like, what's the end outcome of more chaos? Is it likely that more chaos and violence is going to lead to the administration stepping back? Maybe. Certainly, the administration seems to have been somewhat chastened by the two deaths in Minneapolis. Maybe there's a tiny short-term win at the cost of a couple of lives. In the medium term, it's likely that you're going to feed into a mood that gives the administration more license, because they're going to have a pretext and they're going to say, we have to do these things because there's chaos all over the place. And in the longer term, even more deeply, you're creating an environment in which it's harder and harder for both sides to get closer together. You know, you're creating an environment in which it's harder for the people who could be won over from MAGA and the people who could be won over from the center left to find common ground. Because the more open hostility there is on the streets of America, the likelier a descent into civil war becomes. So whilst I think obviously the ultimate people who are responsible for the tragedies in Minneapolis are the agents themselves and the people who sent them there, I would also say that some of the blame goes to the way that the protesters are thinking about protest and the sort of far-left guerrilla model that they're using instead of the Gandhiite model instead. Now, it certainly doesn't help that Immigration Customs Enforcement agents have been encouraged by, at the highest echelons of the Trump administration, to act with as much impunity as they want, with a tacit guarantee that even if they were charged and found guilty, even of murder, they would be pardoned, as long as it happens before Trump leaves office, or his successor, if it's a Republican. Because Stephen Miller, how do we love, don't we love a Stephen Miller? I love me a Stephen Miller. We're going to talk about Stephen Miller in a second. But so he's Trump's top advisor. You know, he's one of the few people who has lasted between Donald Trump's first term and the second term. He's Ezra Klein calls him the prime minister of America to Trump's president. He's basically the one who runs everything while Trump does big picture stuff. So Stephen Miller, he literally told Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers last month, quote, "You have federal immunity in the conduct of your duties. Anybody who lays a hand on you or tries to obstruct you is committing a felony." I mean, could you be clearer than that in saying, don't worry about the rules. We've got your back regardless of what you do. You have federal immunity in the conduct of your duties. Not true constitutionally, but the implication is that even if that was found to be not true in a court of law, they've always got the presidential pardon, to save them. So pivoting from Minneapolis and ICE to the other thing that I think is deeply worrying at the moment is these targeted prosecutions of journalists and presumably soon election officials and previously Federal Reserve Board governor, where you're identifying a target and then retroactively finding a crime instead of the other way around. You know, law enforcement is supposed to be about, here are the things that we want to stop. Okay, you know, there are too many carjackings, so let's stop carjackings. So let's focus on carjackings, and whoever is doing the carjackings is the one who we arrest. What authoritarian regimes do is, instead of following the crime to lead them to the people, they start with the enemies who they want to target, and then they go fishing around in their history to try to find a crime to punish them with. And is there any doubt that this is what's happening here? The former CNN journalist Don Lemon, who's now an independent journalist, he used to be an NBC correspondent as well, appeared frequently on the Today Show and on the NBC Nightly News, long-standing critic of Donald Trump, fearless in his reporting. Now, you don't have to like him, but he's a legitimate journalist. And so he covers this protest in Minneapolis that happens to be taking place in a church because the pastor is himself an ICE agent. I love this. This is, I mean, only in America, right? Would you be a pastor, a religious, a man of the cloth, a pastor who moonlights as an immigration jackboot agent, or perhaps he's an immigration agent who moonlights as a pastor. I don't know. Or maybe it's a 50-50 split. Maybe he's perfectly non-binary. He's they, them in his professional affiliations between spreading the word of the creator of the universe and Jesus's message of love and the meek shall inherit the earth. And on the other hand, going and rounding up people off the streets whilst wearing a mask and sending them to who knows where. So anyway, there's this pastor, and so the protesters have arranged to go into the church, and they disrupt the church. Well, as you will know if you heard my episode about a week ago, which was about specifically Don Lemon, but just in case you didn't, I'll just recap it. There is a law in America called the FACE Act, F-A-S-E, F-A-C-E, rather. And it was brought in order to criminalize people who were protesting at abortion clinics and preventing women who were pregnant from going in and accessing reproductive health services and abortions from being spat on or blocked or whatever. So it criminalized the act of impeding someone from accessing a fertility clinic, an abortion clinic. In order to get the bill through, they had to say they had to placate some of the religious members of Congress by saying, "Well, okay, I'll tell you what. Why don't we also make it apply to places of worship? You can't impede and obstruct someone's access to an abortion clinic, and you also can't impede or obstruct someone's access to a place of worship." Okay, fine, great. That's the compromise. We're done. That's the law. The law has only ever been used in the case of the abortion clinics. It's never been used in its second iteration as being about places of worship. This is the first time when these protesters, along with Don Lemon, entered a church. Don Lemon was asking the pastor some questions. He flies back to Los Angeles to cover the Grammy Awards, and he gets a knock on the door, and he's under arrest for apparently impeding people's ability to conduct a service in that church. And a second charge, which is being part of a conspiracy to do the same, even though he wasn't the one. I mean, he wasn't part of the conspiracy because he wasn't organizing it, but he was there. This is, again, an obvious example of a person who Donald Trump has spoken about many times in the past as being a hack. He's an enemy of the people. He's, you know, part of the fake news. He's peddling lies. Then he covers unfavorably a large national event which Trump wants to look good in the eyes of the public, and all of a sudden there's some reason, there's some legalistic reason why he should be arrested and charged, even though America also ostensibly has freedom of the press enshrined in its constitution. Just stepping back a bit and going to that 30,000-foot sort of essay planning question, rather than getting dug sort of too distracted by the minutiae of the legalities of this or the constitutionality of it. If you've traveled to a poor country where corruption is endemic, and I have been to many throughout West Africa, throughout Southeast Asia, throughout the Indian subcontinent, throughout the Middle East, throughout Eastern Europe, you notice how hard it must be to eradicate bad human norms and to develop institutions that sustain better norms. You know, it's really not easy to establish the delicate balance of what we would call Western civilization or what we would call liberal democracy. Once it's an ordinary thing for people in power to, sure, why not make their enemies' lives a little bit harder by slapping a prosecution on them or accepting money favorably from companies or people who want to curry favor with you, it's extremely difficult to eradicate because every bone in our mammalian primate bodies wants to do those things. Of course we want to be retributive. Of course we want to grease our own palms. Who wouldn't? The only reason we don't is because we live in a society in which we've got this finely balanced kind of Jenga puzzle, this sort of Tower of Babel where we're all holding together just by the skin of our teeth, a set of norms and interlocking institutions that defend those norms that prevent that from happening. So I think sort of squabbling over, well, you know, he shouldn't have been in the church, or maybe actually he was in breach of the FACE Act, or maybe there was something about the Georgia election, and, you know, doesn't the FBI have a right after all to make sure that elections are clean? And, you know, you take every case in isolation. You know, should Peretti, he shouldn't have been wearing a gun. You know, well, don't immigration, you know, surely illegal immigrants do have to be deported somehow, and it's always going to be a little bit messy. it's very easy, I think, especially for my friends and colleagues on the right, to compartmentalize each thing and to find rationales as to why there could be a pretext or a justification that makes some sense for them. But you can't lose the big picture, which is that there is an outrageous and egregious overreach at the moment of the American administration in terms of its self-dealings, in terms of its vindictive prosecutions, in terms of its authoritarian-style sort of shock and awe approach towards law enforcement, especially when it comes to immigration. And I'm not even talking at all in this episode, by the way, about foreign policy. I mean, I did an editorial a couple of weeks ago about Venezuela and about, I think it was called Josh's Big Dick, Little Dick theory of American militarism. So you can go back and listen to that if you want for the international side of things. But I'm just talking about the domestic rights of Americans and the capacity of American democracy to sustain itself and not descend into civil war or some such. There's, speaking of ICE, and the kind of thinking about things in an overly minute perspective and a far too detailed perspective and sort of missing the forest for the trees. Matt Walsh, who's a right-wing commentator in the States, tweeted this as a parody. He tweeted, "The ICE situation is really complex. My take is more nuanced. I want our immigration laws to be enforced, but I just want them to do it without using any force and without anyone ever getting hurt and without anything sad or upsetting happening ever. And if the people we're trying to deport don't want to be deported, or if liberal activists don't want us to deport them, then obviously in that case we shouldn't do it. But I'm totally a conservative on the issue. Unless people get really mad at me, then never mind, please don't yell. I'm sorry." Okay, funny. If you're a completely unnuanced, black and white fucktard. A great retort to that was, I think it was Ross Douthat. I've only got the quote here, which I've stripped away during my readings. I should really be better at annotating things. Or maybe I need a little monkey by my side to jot down what I'm saving on my phone. And the response was essentially an attempt to defend the position that Matt Walsh is satirizing there. Matt Walsh is implying that it's not possible to be serious about immigration enforcement if you're also too squeamish about scenes of heartbreak. You know, if you want illegal immigrants to leave the country and apply properly and come into the country legally, and if those people have children, then you're going to face a tough decision. You're either going to have to separate the family or you're going to have to deport a U.S. citizen child. And to pretend that there aren't these trade-offs is a fatuous lie, I suppose, is Matt's point. But it must have been either Ezra Klein or Ross Douthat, because I can tell that this is from the New York Times, and it would have been one of them, makes the following point. There are conflicts that can't be wished away, such as the conflict I just articulated about deporting a child, and there are a million other ones that you can think of in the space of law enforcement. You know, you're gonna be challenged to do things in a humane way. There are conflicts here that can't be wished away, but the fact that some backlash and resistance are inescapable doesn't mean that all enforcement strategies that generate backlash are sound or wise. That is a good logical point. That's great. Did you miss it? Were you driving? Were you changing lanes? Were you doing the dishes? Did you just drop an egg that you're cleaning up in the kitchen? I'll read it again. The fact that some backlash and resistance are inescapable doesn't mean that all enforcement strategies that generate backlash are sound or wise. Right. There is a way of deporting illegal immigrants in the United States that does not involve an intentionally spectacular visual shock and awe show of masked agents roaming around and hustling people into vans and whisking them away. You could certainly start with local jails, and I think it's absolutely insane that there are some local municipalities and states that are not allowing ICE agents to seize illegal immigrants who are in jail. I mean, yeah, come on. If you want to prevent the craziness that we're seeing, if you want to prevent Trumpism from getting even worse, you have to be willing to meet them on their most reasonable demands so that their most reasonable voters have some chance of swinging over to your side. Otherwise, you've lost the game before it started. And it would strike me as completely reasonable that if you knowingly broke into the United States and stayed there without permission, something that many other countries tolerate far less than America. I mean, in Australia, you know, one reason we don't have ICE agents roaming around causing the mayhem that they are in the United States at the moment is because we haven't spent the past 20 or 30 years allowing uncontrolled illegal immigration. We've had strict border policies, very generous legal immigration, one of the world's highest humanitarian resettlement rates of refugees. But if you overstay your visa in Australia and you're working here illegally, you can be damn sure there's going to be a knock on your door by immigration agents. You can be damn sure that you're going to get deported. There's no question about it. It is, you know, the level of illegal immigration in Australia is vanishingly low because it is properly enforced, not with spectacular masked agents running down the street and wrestling people to the ground and throwing them into vans, but with targeted law enforcement, the way that, you know, law enforcement is supposed to be when you watch LA Law, I mean, yes, if you put the FBI, if you put a proper FBI agency on how do you get rid of illegal immigrants in the country, starting with the most violent, then yes, you would go to jails first and you would say, okay, anyone who came in illegally and then committed a crime here, you have absolutely no, I mean, you had no right to be here to begin with because you didn't come in through proper channels. And now you certainly have no right to be here because you came in without the right to be here and then you hurt us and you broke our laws. So get the fuck out. That's totally legitimate. And the fact that there are cities and states that are refusing to allow ICE agents in out of this grand principle of no human is illegal is crazy. What do you mean no human is illegal? A human is illegal to the extent that they do illegal things. I mean, if I break the law, then I'll be illegal in the context of having broken that law. This is silliness. And it'll keep Democrats out of power in perpetuity if they continue banging on about it. So, yes. Thinking about things from this 30,000-foot perspective, understanding that there are going to be trade-offs, understanding that our goal should be to understand what the trend line of the administration is rather than squabbling over every specific detail or getting agitated about every latest thing that you see pop up on your Instagram feed. That's not going to get us anywhere. And then being maximally generous, I suppose, to the most reasonable version of the argument that could win over people who are not the Stephen Millers of the world or the Donald Trumps of the world, but who just want an alternative to vote for. What makes this so hard, of course, is that we live in separate echo chambers of information at the moment. I was listening to the Slate Political Gabfest, which is a show that I highly recommend. And David Plotz, who's a friend of mine and someone I admire enormously, was talking about, you know, he just thinks this is going to be disastrous for the Trump administration and for Trump's popularity, because when you see all these awful images coming out of the child being taken away by ICE agents in Minnesota and Alex Paretti being shot and Good being shot, and, you know, it's just going to be awful. You see these specific images of these specific individuals and suddenly it lands for you in a way that, you know, the theoretical idea doesn't land. You know, you see the crying eyes of the person you see. And I was thinking to myself, what do you mean we? What do you mean we see this? What do you mean you see this, one sees this? Who is this universal, cohesive group of people who are sitting down and watching Walter Cronkite every evening and reading the New York Times in the morning and are living in a shared reality? You know what the last social media image that I had seen before Plotz said that his feed was full of teary-eyed illegal immigrants being deported or, you know, protesters being shot? The last social media post I had seen, and it's funny because here's the thing about being a journalist, because you research so much stuff, the algorithms that track you and the cookies and all that, they don't quite know what to serve you. So Google and, you know, like Meta are totally confused about what my politics are, because one day I'll be researching, you know, how to be a good neo-Nazi, and then the next I'll be like, why is Israel the greatest, you know, country in the world? So my Facebook feed is just, when they have the suggestions from places that I don't follow, but it's like, you might like this. It'll be like, you might like this thing that you definitely will not like, but we don't know what to make of you. So on this day, it was an ad for ICE. ICE, the Immigration Customs Enforcement, not meth. It wasn't an ad for meth. I haven't gone that far down, although that may be next, depending on Meta's algorithms, and not an ad for frozen water, but an ad for Immigration Customs Enforcement. And it said it had a photo, it was a mugshot of a very nasty-looking Latino, young Latino guy, and it had his name, Eduardo such and such, and it was like, convicted of 3 rapes, you know, a murder and a kidnapping. And it said, one more bad guy that ICE has deported. And it was like, join ICE or something like that down the bottom. And if your media feed is images of criminals who had previously been allowed to stay in the country illegally, who are now no longer roaming the streets, potentially threatening to rape your daughter, you would have a very different idea about what motivates people to object to those kinds of law enforcement activities than Alex Peretti did. And until we can find a way to maximize the number of shared norms and shared experiences and minimize the number of ones that only we and our cohort are seeing, I don't know how we get around that problem. Speaking of ICE training, what did I have here? I had an amazing statistic. Oh, here we go. This is from The Economist. They had a piece about ICE recruiting, right? And this is amazing. So, look, I'll just read it verbatim instead of skimming it mentally and then doing a hash job of trying to rearticulate it. From The Economist. This is about how part of the problem is that Donald Trump is intentionally politicizing his sort of, I don't want to call them armed agencies, but essentially he or Stephen Miller or both want agencies like ICE, which have weaponry, to become more tools of their own policy goals than objective enforcers of state power that lie over the top of government. Indeed, they're trying to do that with the FBI as well, quite shamelessly, as in the case of the seizure of electoral ballots in Georgia. So they're targeting, they've got massive recruiting. Also, another thing that was amazing, which John Dickerson pointed out, who recently left Face the Nation at CBS, terrific journalist, he pointed out that in the, you know, the Trump's big, beautiful bill, that big, beautiful bill, hidden in the big, beautiful bill, which nobody really remarked upon at the time or saw, was a massive increase in funding for ICE. And there was so much else that was wrong with that bill, massive tax cuts and for the rich and so on, that everybody focused on those things. But only now are we seeing the fruit of that particular strategy. Where I think there was the increase in funding for ICE detention facilities was quadrupled. I think that was the stat, quadrupled. It's not like a 20% increase. It's a 400% increase on ICE detention. And the increase in money that they were giving to ICE, and there was another agency which escapes me, but in a similar vein with a similar remit, those increases were completely unconnected to any congressional, command, right? So in other words, the discretion was entirely at ICE. They were just giving them the money without saying, this is money that you should use to do X, Y, Z. They were just, here is a huge amount more money, do with it what you will. So then you're trusting that the kinds of people who are running these agencies, who are handpicked by Donald Trump, are the sorts of people who are going to use that money in ways that will enhance the security of the American people, not in ways that will achieve an agenda for Donald Trump and his political party. So The Economist writes, both ICE and Border Patrol, for instance, weirdly, they're separate agencies, which I still don't quite understand, but basically Border Patrol is actually the physical border and ICE is Immigration Customs Enforcement. When you get off a plane at LAX from abroad or JFK, the people who interview you at customs and look at your passport is ICE because is that Border Patrol and ICE is behind the scenes? Anyway, doesn't matter. They functionally operate the same way. ICE and Border Patrol, for instance, were recruiting in December at America Fest, which is an avowedly Trumpy right-wing conference. ISIS recruit. So just imagine that. There's a political conference, unashamedly and openly partisan, and they send recruitment agents to that place in order to target people with that particular worldview to come on board. Not people who are interested in law enforcement because they like forensics, because they're nerds about community safety, because they have the interests of public service or public policy at heart, but because they intentionally have a worldview that is presumably likely to be consistent with Stephen Miller's and Donald Trump's, which is that there are too many people from shithole countries coming into this country and we need to get real and shut it down. So there's that. Second, ISIS recruiting portal. So you go to the website. If you officially want to apply for a job at ICE, this is what it says. America has been invaded by criminals and predators. We need you capitalized to get them out. You do not need an undergraduate degree. America has been invaded by criminals and predators. That's the way that the impartial enforcement agency, simply following the rules, is characterizing its mission. Several ICE recruitment posts on social media, writes The Economist, include dog whistles such as, "Which way, American man?" an allusion to a white supremacist book, and "Destroy the flood," a slogan from a video game about invasive parasitic aliens. New recruits are rushed through training in 42 days. 42 days. Think about that. 42 days. A month and a bit. That's all the training you get before you're armed and trying to fend off protesters who are protecting people who they don't think should be deported, or going into homes and trying to drag people who've been living in this country for perhaps 10 years peacefully, and drag them out and send them back to a place that they may no longer even know if they ever did, depending on how young they are. Many recruits are rushed through training in 42 days. Many of them are former cops and veterans, but some will never have held a gun before, says a former ICE official. In contrast, it can take up to a year for a local police officer to be deemed street ready. So 42 days for an ICE officer, 365 days for a cop. So I just thought that was interesting. Stephen Miller. Let's just talk a little bit about Stephen Miller. I'm only halfway through a fabulous episode of one of my favorite podcasts, which you have to listen to if you're in Australia, and you ought to listen to if you're not. It's called If You're Listening. It's an ABC podcast by Matt Bevan, who's been on this show and who's a friend of mine. And he is one of the best in the business, I think, anywhere in the world at breaking down complicated ideas in a funny, whimsical, sort of tongue-in-cheek, but really informative and just vastly nerdy and intricate and delightful way. And the latest episode goes through, and If You're Listening is a reference to Donald Trump's speech during the debate with Hillary Clinton, where he said, Russia, if you're listening, you know, you could leak some stuff on Hillary Clinton. And shortly thereafter, there was this dump of information about Hillary Clinton, which reopened the FBI Comey case and many argue lost Hillary Clinton the election. Oh man, what a different world it would be. Isn't it just crazy? Do you ever think about like the sort of butterfly effect of, you know, how just random shit could have changed things? Like, you know, 600 people in Florida in the year 2000 just get out of bed in the morning and just decide to vote for Al Gore instead of George W. Bush. And then is there no Iraq war? Maybe. Did we get a handle on climate change? Maybe. But then on the other hand, we probably don't get Barack Obama, right? Because if you didn't have the George W. Bush administration and Dick Cheney and everyone getting so frustrated with that administration, what was perceived as that administration's right-wing overreach, you probably wouldn't have had the space for an Obama to come along. So do we have to thank those voters in Florida in 2000 who did vote for George W. Bush for giving us Barack Obama subsequently? But then you get Obama, and without Obama, you probably don't have Trump, because the conservative base probably has more tolerance for traditional republicanism than they would have if they'd felt so outraged at this smug professorial black dude in the Oval Office. So anyway, I just always think about that stuff. So yeah, the things could certainly have gone differently. And Stephen, and so if you're listening, is this, you know, great podcast? It started out being an investigation, a deep dive into the Russia collusion hoax, as some people call it, the Russia collusion theory. And he subsequently, it was so good that everyone just wanted more of it. So then there was a season about China, and now it's basically just a show about any sort of international foreign policy intrigue that's interesting. And the latest episode is about Stephen Miller. And Matt reveals like audio of Stephen Miller from when he was a teenager and when he was an aspiring student politician and so on. And he was a real smartass. Like, he was a funny clown. And he would say incredibly outrageous things. There's audio of him giving a speech when he's running for, I think, student president. And he's saying, like, is anyone else sick and tired of being told to pick up their own trash when we have janitors who are paid $25 an hour working in this school who should be picking up the goddamn trash for us? And the crowd goes, all the kids go wild. So, and he's, you know, the audio of him saying, being asked about the Iraq War. I guess he was in, we're probably contemporaries because he's pretty young. He was, I guess, in college at the time of the Iraq War. And he goes, well, what would I do with Saddam Hussein and the senior officials? I wouldn't kill them because I'm a humane person. I would torture them and cut off their fingers because that is the humane thing to do, because torture is the humane solution. It's the solution that respects life. And Matt raises the point on the podcast, is this just trolling and shit talking? Because it certainly sounds like it when he's young. But now he is a person who is, as I said earlier, overtly instructing immigration officials that they have full federal immunity in the conduct of their duties, and anybody who lays a hand on them is committing a felony. He's a person who is, you know, pushing, who was one of the masterminds of the blowing up boats in the Caribbean with drones and going into Venezuela, along with Marco Rubio, and is most known for his, maybe white nationalism is too harsh. White supremacy is certainly too harsh, but I think white nationalism is probably, or ethnic nationalism for America, shall we say, the belief that there is just way too much immigration and that immigrants are a drain on the United States rather than something that is good. Someone who believes that the idea that diversity is strength is nonsense, that unity is strength, ethnic unity is strength, and America should no longer be, the shining light on the hill for immigrants, but should be a place where basically white middle-class people, and certainly legal white middle-class people, even that is weird, because, like, would he have as much antipathy towards a Canadian or a Norwegian or an Australian overstaying their visa in the United States? It's hard to know. I can't get inside his head. But anyway, this question of Stephen Miller, people around him, people like him. So I'm trying to differentiate between the true believers in the Trump administration and the people who are either just shit posting or their yes men, their lapdogs. And the question becomes people ask me quite a lot, does Trump believe what he says? Does Stephen Miller believe what he says? When Trump says that the 2020 election was stolen, does he believe it? And I've come to believe that the question of belief is suspect in this case. And the reason why this is important is because I think it will inform how we ought to interpret and stand up to this moment and hopefully create a better future that will reinforce American democracy rather than undermine it. Because I think that Donald Trump is a transactional human being who believes in the things that it is necessary to believe in order to achieve the goals that he thinks are worth achieving. By which I mean, when he says that he won the 2020 election, does he think it's true? Well, I don't think that he is bothered about the question of whether or not the atoms in the universe, when they assembled themselves into ballot papers and were counted, were actually legitimately in his favor. I think the way his brain seems to work, and I'm just guessing here, total speculation, but I've met some people like this. The way his brain seems to work is that the world is a game of power, and you can shape reality into what you want reality to be. And there's something a little bit mediocre and low testosterone about just accepting the truth because it happens to be the fact about the way things are. You create your own truth. So if believing that the 2020 election was stolen is a useful prerequisite to getting elected in 2024, then by definition, it's true. It's true because it achieves the outcomes that you want to achieve. No one will ever know the actual truth of the atoms, and who gives a shit about the atoms and the ballot papers and the numbers and the facts on the ground. Facts are created by powerful people. History is written by the victors. And so I sort of think it's a moot question. Like, do they believe what they have goals they want to achieve. They want to be powerful. They have a vision of America that they want, which is a much more mono-ethnic country where it's very easy to get rich if you're a privileged white person. And whatever they need to claim that they believe, or actually even believe, in order to enact that, will be judged by the utility of it. You know, I think it's sort of beside the question of saying, do they believe it or not? In some ways, this is a bit of an aside, but I've been thinking about writing a column about this. In some ways, it reminds me a bit of when you get into an argument with someone who is an AI skeptic, and they say, oh, all the large language models are doing is they're just sophisticated autocompletes. They're brainless things that are just spitting out the next thing, the next bunch of letters that they think they should spit out. You're just being hoodwinked into thinking that there's anything going on there. To which I kind of feel, well, they're doing things that are very strange and seem innovative, and they're helping me to think about things, and they're helping me to write things, and they're helping me to plan things, and they're enormously useful in ways that an autocomplete isn't. So if you want to call that a glorified autocomplete, be my guest. It doesn't change the fact. I mean, I almost feel like you could have like a sentient large language AI overlord, and you would still be able to accuse it of being a glorified autocomplete. I mean, you could accuse me of being a glorified autocomplete in the sense that I've ingested all of the information that has ever occurred before me. It has gone into my brain, and my neurons are firing right now, and they're spurting out words in a way that even I don't know what the next fourth word I'm going to say is. I'm not in charge. I'm not in control of this monologue. This is not written. I can't tell you what the next sentence I'm going to say is. All of the information has gone into my brain, and I'm just auto-completing what I think is the most sensible thing to say next. That it strikes me as that kind of sort of sophistry, that sort of like academic professorial nonsense. And similarly, I think we make the same mistake when we're like, well, does the Trump administration really, think that it's doing the right thing? Or does it think that it's true that that it's going cracking down on illegal immigration in the correct way? Is it think it's true that the ballots needed to be seized in order to, like, I think they think that what is true is what it works. History is a story of people being able to create the realities that they want through the narratives that they construct. So choose your narrative. I think that's the way they think about this. But again, that's only a suspicion. I have no way of verifying that. So then you get to the weird part of this whole thing, which is the people who are, there's no question that they don't believe in it, but they go along with it anyway. Like the yes men. So I would have thought that Tulsi Gabbard was one of these people, the head of national security, who went down to Georgia and called Trump in front of the FBI agents, who has no role, who only went because Donald Trump personally asked her to. And so she was a Democrat, and she was a servicewoman. She served in Iraq, I think, or Afghanistan. And she became perhaps slightly deranged by COVID and became quite conspiratorial. She was on the far left of the Democratic Party that can get so far left and so conspiratorial that it actually becomes right wing, like Naomi Wolf, some people might say Glenn Greenwald, people like that, who you now, the distance between them and Steve Bannon is like quite slim. The question of these people, I can only assume that it's cowardice. I can only assume that I mean, to be honest, this is actually the bit of everything that's going on that I understand the least. I sort of understand. I mean, I don't understand because you would have to have such a tiny dick to be a congressman. I was going to say I sort of understand, like being in Congress and not wanting to have Donald Trump tweet mean things about you, and maybe not having to run, not being able to run again, or even potentially being threatened, you know, by crazies if he cares about you that much. But the idea that that would not be a price you would pay in order to object to a trend that is so obviously dangerous. I mean, even if you think there's some justification for it, it obviously turns the dial up on the likelihood that American democracy does not succeed, is baffling to me. But even more, even if I could believe that, because I could believe being a coward, I can't understand the Tulsi Gabbards and the people in the administration who were not true believers, but who came in, you know, Marco Rubio would be another person like this, who came in because it was a job, and maybe they thought they could restrain Trump in some ways or help, you know, enact some of the things that they care deeply about. But there's only, it strikes me, there's only two ways that history will remember these people. Either American democracy will restore itself and they will be remembered as participating in one of the darkest and most dangerous eras in American democracy, or their modus operandi will become the norm and America will enter a period of essentially alternating authoritarian regimes and some form of perhaps civil war, low grade, you know, not civil war like the American Civil War where there are trenches, but civil war like the Balkan Civil War, where there's, I mean, it's too horrible to think about, but, you know, the enemy within is constantly is who you're battling against. So in that second scenario where they so their MO becomes the norm, then they will be remembered as the first administration that seriously executed an authoritarian paradigm, which replaced the post-World War II democratic peace in America. I don't think either of those options are good for them. Like, if you lose and American democracy restores itself, then you are a member of one of the darkest chapters. If you win and the dark chapter continues, then you are complicit in having brought it about. You know, if they win, then they usher in an era in which they will be remembered as awful instigators of a new way of doing things. And if they lose, then they'll be remembered as people who tried to derail the American experiment. So those are the people who I really don't understand. I mentioned the low-grade civil war. What's tricky about responding to this moment, and here I reach the conclusion of my essay, ladies and gentlemen, is it's easy in isolation to notice the authoritarianism of the Trump administration and to think that the best way to fight it is to ensure that authoritarianism doesn't triumph in the United States. What if the gravest risk is not one-party rule, Stalinism in America, or Nazism, or a Holocaust, or something like that, but a kind of Balkan-style civil war where neighbor is against neighbor and everyone is armed and there's bombings and shootings going on all over the place between extremists who live amongst us and are trying to, I don't want to say exterminate, but maybe expurgate from the nation, the enemies of the state on whichever side. So the right would believe that the country is trying to be taken over by neo-Marxist left-wing leftist fascists who are lawless and want to inundate the country with as many illegal immigrants as possible in order to replace the native-born population, particularly the white population, with hordes from the third world that will make America indistinguishable from Somalia. And the right-wing people just feel they're not going to tolerate that, and they're not going to tolerate the breakdown of the family, and they're not going to tolerate their kids in public schools being told that it's okay to for boys to suck each other's cocks if they want to, and it's just okay for you know, boys to turn into girls, and for girls in change rooms to have other quote unquote girls with dicks walking in. It's just all way too far. That's the vision of that's the vision that the right will have of the left, and they'll have to take matters into their own hands. And at the same time, people who are on the left will feel like there is an authoritarian Nazi takeover of the country, and that fascists who are rearing their head in America again and labeling people as illegal and trying to shoot citizens in the street are fundamentally un-American and spit in the face of the American tradition of immigration and openness, and they have to be defeated. You can easily see that coming about. There are four issues that are identified in another article in The Economist, which is about the slide into authoritarianism. And I think they're worth talking about. This is from they've interviewed experts about authoritarianism and to try to figure out the characteristics, because I think it's important for us to understand whether or not we're just being hysterical when we talk about fascism, or I really don't think fascism is a good word, or authoritarianism here. So they identify four experts, not the economists themselves, but the experts in authoritarianism who look at authoritarianism all over the world and the way that it unfolds, have four characteristics. First, authoritarians encourage loyalty, people are usually well paid, right? So this is about creating forces that are answerable only to the state. This is a little bit like what I was implying, that the FBI and Immigration Customs Enforcement are becoming under Donald Trump. They're not objective arms of the state to which we all belong. They are sort of personal. They are increasingly encouraged to be answerable to the regime that happens to be in power. Let's put it that way, to be as careful as we can with our words and non-hysterical. So to strengthen the would-be ways that would-be authoritarians often try to strengthen their grip on power by creating forces answerable only to themselves. One, to encourage loyalty, they're usually paid well. So they pay this huge funding for ICE, for example. So you look at Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, which is the arm of state terror in Iran, then they report directly to the Supreme Leader. They're not law enforcement. They have a much larger budget than the regular army, and their officers are because the officers, rather not the officers, the officers of the Guard Corps are able to use that money to run lucrative businesses on the side, often coercive ones. They can run mini mafia operations on the side, and the government will turn a blind eye because they're members of the IRGC. So ICE gets paid an enormous amount of money. Second, whereas regular military forces are supposed to be politically neutral, at least in democracies, unorthodox ones may be fiercely partisan. India's Hindu nationalist paramilitary groups, who tend to carry sticks rather than guns, are open about their support for the ruling party. So that's another way that you try to get a stranglehold on power, by creating forces that only answer to you. You have a partisan slant to it. So there you have the recruiting stands at those partisan events in order to get ICE agents, in order to make sure that ICE consists of people who believe in you and who are rallying for you as a partisan political figure, not as a head of state for everybody. Third, a strong man's pet force is often allowed to break the law. Does that ring bells of Stephen Miller's line to ICE? You have federal immunity in the conduct of your duties. That's it. He's saying you can break the law and you have immunity thanks to us. So you owe us potentially your life if you end up committing a murder, for example, and we pardon you. A strongman's pet force is often allowed to break the law. Thirdly, in Venezuela, as an example, it's illegal to kidnap and torture dissidents or to stand outside polling stations shooting bullets into the air to intimidate voters. But motorbike gangs, known as colectivos, are sponsored by the regime and have done so without fear of arrest. So you outsource it. Allow them to break the law. And lastly, fourthly, Leaders who sponsor the regular use of force nearly always claim it's to protect the public. This is the fourth characteristic. So the four characteristics of would-be authoritarians who are trying to strengthen their grip on power by developing forces that are only answerable to them, or more answerable to them than you would want a force, a state force to be, which is supposed to be operating on behalf of everybody, are pay them well, and just see the fourfold increase in budget for ICE detention in Trump's big, beautiful bill. Pay them well. Allow them to be, try to make them partisan rather than politically neutral. There's a long-standing tradition of political neutrality for the army and the police in all democracies. So now you have these agencies like ICE being intentionally recruited in politically partisan arenas. Third, allow your pet strongmen to break the law. We've seen Stephen Miller, effectively Prime Minister of the United States, openly say that all ICE agents are beyond the law. And fourth, claim that it's to protect the public. And the example on the fourth issue might be the Philippines, where Rodrigo Duterte, won the presidency by promising to, quote, forget the laws on human rights when fighting drug dealers. He urged the police to, quote, fatten all the fish of Manila Bay with the corpses of criminals to make the streets safe again. So again, making the streets safe again as a pretext. This is all familiar stuff. And it plays into the point that I was making earlier about my skepticism as to whether or not the best way to push back against such behavior is by fomenting violence against ICE agents in the streets, because that plays perfectly into point four there, into strategy four, tactic four of the would-be authoritarian who's trying to strengthen his grip on power by creating forces which are answerable only to him, which is to give him a reason, a way to say that he's protecting the public. He's only protecting the public. So, civil war versus authoritarianism and preventing civil war. It's tricky because the things that you might want to do to prevent authoritarianism, you might think could enhance the likelihood of a civil war, like standing up more aggressively to Trump could increase partisanship and alienation and division and violence. And conversely, the things that you might think you want to do to avoid a civil war, like try to find a way for all Americans to get on the same page, might impede your ability to stand up to MAGA by making you more leery about being highly politically partisan at this moment and denouncing the Republican Party. I think it's a false choice. I think if we're going to channel Gandhi and Martin Luther King when we're thinking about nonviolent civil disobedience, which I would strongly encourage, and there may be some kind of economic sanction that could happen here. I know that Scott Galloway, the head of the business school at NYU, has argued that Americans should just cancel their AI subscriptions because AI is the only thing that is making the American economy grow at the moment. And if every American, or if even 20% of Americans canceled their subscriptions to ChatGPT and so on, the American economy would shrink, it would go into recession, and it would be, to me, I just think that collective action like that is probably not going to happen and is such a long shot that it's not worth focusing on, but I kind of like the idea. But civil disobedience rather than guerrilla fomenting of violence as opposition to the jackbooted thugs strikes me as very wise. And if we're going to talk about MLK and Gandhi, I think the great person who we should look to in moments like this, when we think about societies and countries that could have descended into civil war, that got right to the brink and had every reason to, in fact, where one side was perfectly justified in trying to punish people who either wanted to or successfully did derail democracy, but refused to do so and managed to sort of avoid that train wreck, you would have to think of Nelson Mandela and South Africa. I mean, after apartheid, there was no reason. And in fact, the argument for continuing apartheid in the 70s and 80s was less that it was a great system, really, and more that if we allow the majority black people in South Africa to have a say, they're going to fucking slaughter us. I mean, they're going to kill us. This was the same argument, by the way, in America towards the end of slavery. I mean, part of the thinking was not just, you know, that it was the right thing to do to keep slaves. It was like, what do you expect us to do if we liberate them? They're going to, what do you think? They're just going to roll over and just be happy, go away happily? They're going to come in and they're going to cut it, slash our throats. And the way that it didn't happen, well, America's a different story because it actually had a civil war to decide that. But that was, in some sense, a voluntary civil war. And in the sense that Lincoln could have just allowed the southern states to secede if he'd wanted to. But in the South African case, there was a conscious strategy on the part of Nelson Mandela. When he got into power, he could have hunted down all of the white supremacists who had punished him. I mean, who were running the country, remember? I mean, you think Stephen Miller's a racist? We had people, you know, who had just been running the country 3 months ago in South Africa who had been presiding over the most openly fascistic and overtly racist regime in the world. And what did Nelson Mandela do? Did he prosecute them? Did he hound them? Did he try to find trumped-up charges to bring them down with and ruin their lives? Not only did he not do that, not only did he let them go free, he insisted that they work in his administration, that they work with him in his cabinet, because he recognized the only way to move forward was to not be a coward, right? Not say, oh, it was all right, I'm not going to stand up for what I believe in. To say, these are my conditions, that is gone, we're not going to do any of that anymore. But we're also not going to relitigate the past. We're going to work together to figure out what a future looks like. And there absolutely could have been a civil war post-apartheid in South Africa. There were many more reasons why there should have been than there are for why there should be a civil war in America right now. And part of the mechanism in South Africa were truth and reconciliation commissions, where they would actually have full investigations into what happened, where people could speak about what had happened, speak about their desires, articulate how they were wronged, and find some sort of reconciliation. This reminds me a little bit of the conversation that I had recently with Nicholas Gruen, I believe, who was talking about citizens' assemblies. It's a great episode. If you haven't listened to it, you should. The idea that part of the democratic process, that our democracies have become so estranged from the views of the average citizen, we're essentially ruled by a cabal of professional politicians who are dependent on enormous corporations to fund their campaigns and who are quite non-responsive on a number of issues to voter will. And they're also captive to the social media cycle, to the relentless media cycle. And they're so cautious about doing anything because they're always worried about the mob on social media. And that the voters, too, are caught in a cycle of an attention economy where we're deranged by algorithms. And so one of the solutions that Nicholas Gruen advocates is something that they did in Ireland, for example, before the gay marriage referendum there. They had citizens' assemblies where you were called up, like you might be for jury duty, and you were assembled in a demographically relevant, consistent way. So there were people from all kinds of communities, and you might have a very homophobic religious pastor with a very gay, you know, gay rights activist. And they'd be sitting at the same table. They would have tables of like a half dozen people in a hall. They would hear speakers. People would come in and inform them about what the law would be, about, you know, how rights would be dealt with and so on. And they would hash it out and they would talk about it. And so instead of getting your information from algorithms or from editorials in the news media, you would get it from talking to other people. And the idea of having a kind of a standing citizen's body in a country, in a democracy, that can deliberate on the decisions that are before parliament, just so that you could see, I mean, they may even be non-binding initially, but that you could just see whether or not regular people who are selected randomly by jury, according to a process that is similar to a jury registration, whether or not they would arrive at decisions that are consistent with or antithetical to what our elected representatives are coming to. And if there was a consistent difference, you know, if the People's Assembly, through a number of cycles of different citizens who'd been called up, was consistently, after thoughtful deliberation, coming to different conclusions than Parliament was, then maybe, well, certainly it would embarrass politicians. It would give the politicians who were only voting with their party grudgingly but actually agreed with the citizens a reason to be able to justify their switching their vote. Or you could even have a formal trigger where if the Citizens' Assembly votes, I don't know, three times in opposition to what Parliament votes, then Parliament has to re-vote in a blind vote so that the parties have no power. So anyway, there are all these ideas, but these kinds of ways of making it less about narrative and more about humans, and more about reason, more about conversation, shall I say, uncomfortable conversation, is, I suspect, the only way out of where America is. Yes, we have to do our best to, I mean, if you're in politics, obviously you have a different role because you need to be pushing back in a much more active way against every outrage. But I would encourage you and us as a collective of reasonable people who enjoy thinking about conversations with a cool head and a warm heart instead of a hot head and a cold heart. I would encourage us to resist the temptation to freak out about every latest thing. Like, we already know the trajectory. It's sort of neither here nor there what Stephen Miller and Donald Trump do henceforth. Like, yeah, we need to stand up against it. There should be absolutely be civil disobedience. But go into it with a sense of righteousness and love for the American people and the American project and American democracy and for liberalism and for pluralism. And walk with it, walk with your head held high and a sense of courage and purpose and faith in the capacity of American civil society to absorb this threat, not because it's true, but because you have to behave as if it is true if you have any chance of making it so. To hunker down into frightened, fearful camps where your only response to an authoritarian overreach is to go into the streets and try to spit on immigration customs enforcement agents and wrestle them to the ground and risk getting shot, that is not a strategy for winning the big game of avoiding a civil war. Americans are going to need to find a way of cleaving off the extremists so that the people who are genuine diehards on both sides, if you believe that at any cost, all people who are undocumented in the United States should be removed from the country, no matter how, and no matter how many people have to die in the process, or no matter how much it costs, you can't be part of the conversation, really. You're not serious. Conversely, if you believe that no human is illegal, and therefore anyone should be able to come into the country, and if they set foot in the country, then they should be able to stay here indefinitely, you shouldn't be part of the conversation, because you're not serious. But these are vanishingly small fractions of the population. One of them happens to be in power right now. And it's scary to see that enacted. So we need to stop fucking around and trying new experiments with liberal democracy. Maybe we'll give this orange-faced, you know, game show host a try at the top job. These are sophisticated systems of liberal democracy that have established these norms against corruption and state power that are quite difficult to build. If you doubt that, just look at how many places in how many eras have had societies as peaceful and law-abiding and functional as ours. You know, if you start talking about, oh, how hard things are, it's very difficult to buy a house, you know, things are really expensive, have you seen the price of eggs? Part of me just wants to go, shut the fuck up. I mean, go to any, if I give you a dartboard with all of the eras of human history going back, I don't know, 100,000 years? Do you want to go to 10,000 years? Maybe we want to go 2,000 years. As long as human beings have been arranging themselves into societies, and then I give you a dart, and then we also break it down into all of the countries in the world, and I tell you, you get to throw a dartboard at that, what are the odds that your dartboard hits rich Western liberal democracy in the 21st century? And if it hit that, wouldn't you be pretty fucking stoked? I mean, I would. I wouldn't be throwing that dart. I would do anything to get out of that dart room. I don't know which evil genius has come up with the idea of this scenario where he's going to teleport me into that particular time and place. but you would have won the fucking lottery to live in our societies. So this idea that, oh, people are really hurting, you know, the elites just don't get it. We gotta mix things up. We gotta try something really different. Maybe we'll try a bit of, illiberalism for a change. You know, this initially began on the left in academia in the 1960s and Foucault and post-structuralism, and that then bled into social justice, cancel culture, and wokeism. And now we're seeing the ferocious blowback from the right. Just calm down, take a deep breath, recognize that we have a lot to be grateful for, try not to doom scroll a whole bunch. Recognize that the way out of this is most likely to isolate the extremes. It's a little bit like a counterterrorism operation, right? Where your job is to win over the hearts and minds of anyone who's winnable and to cleave them off from the extremists. That is classic counterterrorism. And that's essentially what America has to do right now. Isolate the actual extremists who are unwinnable. That might be 20% of the population. And the remaining 80% who will disagree in all kinds of ways about all kinds of things, but will not die on a hill for some ideological purity test. Those people have to find a way to escape the algorithm, escape the natural sense of fury and partisanship, that feeling like you're suffering an indignity when the other side wins can engender, and talk about the America that they want. I don't know how to do that. I hope that this show contributes to it a little bit. I think that having uncomfortable conversations from a place of generosity and free from bullshit and trying to understand why people, you know, if you're on the left and you're absolutely outraged by what is happening in Minnesota, I think the most useful thing you can do, perhaps other than civil disobedience, peaceful civil disobedience, is to understand why people would vote for that and what the worldview is of the person whose Facebook feed is totally inundated with images like the ad from ICE that I saw about the rapist and murderer who'd been successfully deported by ICE. This doesn't mean that you say, you're saying Nazis, you know, I will get mail saying, oh, so Josh thinks Nazis are okay. Josh is saying we shouldn't stand up to fascism. If it was the 1930s, Josh would be like, oh, we just have to sit down and make friends with Hitler. You know, that's not the point. Some people are unwinnable, and to them, you have to stand up and fight. But if you treat everyone who voted for them and everyone who supports them and everyone who doesn't see the world the same way as you, as being in the same bucket as them, there is no way to escape the inevitable ratcheting up of hostilities into a war of attrition, which will eventually become hot. So it just may be that the best thing to do right now is not necessarily a political act, but an act of the heart and an act of self-care, where we understand each new blip in the news cycle as just one jigsaw in a mosaic whose general picture we already know, which is an administration which is now obviously actively trying to subvert American democracy, subvert the norms of democratic civil life. It is one of the darkest attempted periods in American history, certainly I would say since the Civil War. And once you recognize that, you don't need to keep being a cat with a laser pointer. You can have some faith that maybe, just maybe, uncomfortable conversations will be what save us. I'll see you next time.